Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Hey, everyone. Welcome back to the show. This is the part of the year where the vast majority of folks who have subscribed to support The Realignment and, of course, get exclusive content will be getting hit with their 50 a year annual subscriptions. I was on the road last week. I was moderating a really interesting panel on the realignment or the potential realignment of the Black vote in 2024 and beyond. And I'll be sure to share that when it becomes available on YouTube. But that also just meant that I couldn't record an episode for Thursday or a good one for Tuesday. So I decided to do something a little different. I wanted to kind of give everyone, whether they are subscribers or not, a look into the AMA Q&A function. All the questions are going to be answered there, available to everyone, regardless of their subscription status, and they are questions that have been asked before. If you would like to get the upcoming exclusive Q&A that Sagar and I are going to release this upcoming weekend, you can go to realignment.supercast.com or click the link at the top of the show notes. You'll also be able to submit the type of questions that you're hearing today. Okay, so like I said, I picked, over the course of the past 2 years, so the favorite questions that folks have given or submitted. So we're just going to go down the line. It's kind of late now, so forgive any verbal hiccups you hear in this one narrative episode. Okay, so first question. Yo, what happened to the Something Interesting series? So the Something Interesting series is coming back. It's something that I was particularly proud of. I recorded those towards the end of last year. I did an episode on Black Friday. I did an episode on fraternity drug culture. I did an episode on Michael Jordan. I did an episode on UFOs and aliens and whether or not the government is undergoing a conspiracy to keep news on those subjects hidden. I thought the conversations I recorded were just fun and also get to the core of what I'm really trying to do with this interview format, which is have a interesting conversation. All of the RE Something Interesting episodes, though, weren't inherently political and were a little different than the realignment episodes. I wanted to do those episodes because, frankly, I've been doing this for 5 years and just solely focusing my attentions on politics is pretty debilitating and not, frankly, the healthiest thing to do. So just building out a outlet for me to just have the interviews I always enjoy doing, but on topics that I think will help you understand the country a little better, but also aren't falling into the typical realignment lineup are really, really interesting. So on Thursday, because once again, I've got kind of a log of episodes I need to fill in, I'm going to publish my latest RE Something Interesting episode. It's a great conversation about the state of American clothing manufacturing and efforts to reshore that industry. So it's the perfect mix of, okay, what's the realignment? We like talking about building, we like talking about manufacturing and industry, but also looking at it through the lens of the companies over the 2000s and 2010s that tried to do the very, very hard task of reshoring the country's manufacturing base in the clothing category, which obviously expands into other categories post-COVID as well too. So look forward to hearing that episode, which is going to be a little different than a typical realignment episode, but I think will still be up everyone's alleys. Next question, future goals for the show. What are your long-term goals for the show? In-person interviews, a realignment set, keep up the great work. So I first got asked this question on the AMA Supercast function back in 2022, and my answer has definitely changed. I'd say back in 2022, I don't remember my exact answer, but I suspect I probably said something along the lines of higher production values, in-person set, building out my base in Austin, et cetera. And what I've kind of come to the conclusion around is that after the election, maybe even a little before, I'm probably going to change the show's format a bit. I've recorded more than 500 realignment episodes, not counting the Supercast AMAs. I've recorded another 100 to 200 episodes of Counterbalance, Arsenal of Democracy, and On Deck's podcast, The Deep End, which I used to do. And at this point, I've just put out content for so long, and I've just measured my ability to be a good podcaster purely by can I produce 2 to 3 to 4 to even 5 episodes a week, that I'd like to kind of enter a new era where my focus instead is, hey, do 1 to 2 episodes a week, that first episode being a realignment episode, but is just like the best episode for the category. So instead of doing an episode on, let's say, the arsenal of democracy and the defense industrial base that I kind of do 5 or 6 times throughout the year, what if I took all of the energy and intention that I put towards recording 3 to 4 episodes a week and just produce the best episode on the arsenal of democracy that you can just go back to that year, the year after, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Same thing is true of an episode on conservatism or the progressive movement, immigration policy, all of these different categories. I think there's a real opportunity for me to just say to myself, don't focus on 3 to 4 episodes, focus on just doing the one episode for the category for that year that folks would just really enjoy and get a lot from. If I focused on doing one single episode, that would mean I'd have time to work on the transcripts, could build out the social media clips, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's probably the biggest change that I'm going to make, just definitely like really focusing on honing up the quality. And obviously, in person is always going to be easiest when it comes to that. But if I'm doing these in-person episodes, it will actually be easier to produce them consistently if I'm focusing on once a week. But I did say, though, I would probably try to do 2 a week. But I would say the second episode would be the RE Something Interesting Culture Society episode that I talked about in the previous question. So that's probably the biggest change. I think there are just a lot of like really interesting people, especially Dwarkesh Patel. He has a great podcast out there where he's doing these like once a week, or maybe even once every 2 or 3 week episodes, but he's just so prepped and so built into that specific episode that it is just defining for the category. David Perel, a friend of mine in Austin, Texas, who writes about writing online, just had this really good take recently that during COVID, a lot of online creators really centered their identities around publishing constantly. So like, I'm always sending this newsletter, I'm always publishing this content, I'm always producing. And as I alluded to a little earlier in this question, for me, my self-worth and frankly, like evaluation of myself is really rooted in my ability to just produce really constantly, because during the COVID period, there was just so much opportunity for growth that made the most sense. Instead, what I'm going to shift to gradually and then suddenly is just this idea of like, do the best possible episode. And if that means that only comes out once a week, be okay with that. So that's the thing I'm looking forward to too. It should also be noted that I've been doing the realignment for over 5 years now. And I've always said that at a minimum, this is a 10-year project. So really understanding that projects are going to shift and change as you go is going to be really, really key. It's just really about finding a way you can actually practice this in a proper way. Next question. What do politics mean personally to you? So many people around me just simply don't care about political discourse or just passively absorb a base level of understanding from scrolling through Twitter or cable news. Can you define why you personally pursue a nuanced understanding of America's politics? Love the show. Thanks, guys. So this is an answer which, once again, I answered this in the past. I can't remember what I exactly said, but I'll just say like my honest answer is that when I was in high school and during college, I was just this ultra ambitious, very political person. And I've made this joke to people in person, but I make the joke here. It's very true. My high school email address was kozlov2020@yahoo.com, which, as people from my class of 2010 high school cohort will understand, that's like the definition of the most like 2007 email address ever, down to the yahoo.com aspect. But I was really a person who was just very, very politically ambitious. I went to Boys Nation. It's actually how I got connected with Sagar, because his two best friends were the Texas Boys Nation senators. I was the Oregon senator. I was youth governor of Oregon. I did student Congress. I was state champion. It was just ambition. That kind of led into college, where I got involved in student government. And those of you who know me could know, but if you search Marshall Kozlov, ASUL, you'll get some front articles that I'll talk about a little more deeply someday. But the TLDR of it was, I just really rode being this ambitious political person really into a ditch. I really found myself like really dissatisfied, like really unhappy. The TLDR of the ASUO situation I kind of referred to was, I got involved in student government at University of Oregon, which is a pretty big deal at that school because the budget's really big. Me and my buddies got a little too overly excited and got thrown off a ballot for intimidating a candidate on an opposing slate. After that, the Weekly Standard wrote about it because the author of the article, Mark Hemingway, went to University of Oregon. Total Frat Move wrote about this. There's a recording online that some of you guys will find. It's just really embarrassing stuff. But as that all kind of fell apart, I just found myself sitting at my apartment in 2014, not really knowing what I wanted to do because so much of my identity was based around me being this like ambitious political person. And obviously in the short term, that was just kind of thrown out. So I'd randomly gone to the bookstore and I got this book that I've referenced in the past called The Insurgents by Fred Kaplan. And The Insurgents is this really fascinating book about the U.S. military's efforts via David Petraeus and other people like former realignment guest Dr. John Nagel to transform the U.S. military in the face of the disastrous Iraqi Civil War and all the ways that the U.S. military wasn't set up to actually win the war in Iraq in comparison to the light footprint approach that really led to disaster in 2003, 2004, 2005, and 2006. So I actually just read this book, and it's this fascinating book that's about ideas and individuals and people who can turn their ambition into something that really means something. And, you know, this sounds like a little dramatic and like a little overly narrativized, but I actually think that like reading that book when I read that book helped me get back on track with like my actual serious interest, which is like foreign policy and national security, but also refocused me away from just sort of like ambition for ambition's sake. Like, why exactly did I want to be a congressman in 2020? I can't actually tell you. You know, like that's a very, like, it's like kind of like a low stakes version of Ted Kennedy famously not being able to answer why he wanted to be president in 1980. I definitely couldn't have answered that question, I think, in an intellectually serious or honest way back in the 2010s. So just reading that book was just like the perfect recentering act for me. Evan, the other thing that I read during that summer when I was in DC in 2014 was there's this great piece on reform conservatism, which was all about how the conservative movement was really shifting in ways that actually went on to presage Trump, a former focus on the working class, a focus on the middle class, really responding to the success of the Obama presidency in a different way. And just reading two very idea-centric areas, so once again, like foreign policy, national security, but then also the study of modern conservatism and like evolving ideologies, like it was really this like real effort that set me on the path where I am today. So that just really explains where I'm at. Honestly, there's a degree of like real deep dissatisfaction with who I was as a person and the way that I performed my political interests. So there's a degree of, you know, self-flagellation there, but also there's just this like deeper kind of aspect of like, hey, if I'm going to be in these spaces, if I'm going to do these things, I want to do them the right way in a way that I'm really proud of, as opposed to just being generically ambitious. Okay, next question. We're getting really real on this answer of the Q&A. Next question, Sagar's graduate studies. This question was asked to Sagar directly, but I'll give my version of it. Hey guys, I greatly appreciate the work you all are doing. I wondered if Sagar could talk a little more about his graduate studies. I'm finishing a master's program and I'm considering an additional graduate degree. My course of study is predominantly in national security / defense policy, and I'd like to hear Sagar's perspective on his degree. So Sagar gave his perspective on his degree in the previous episode, I believe a year or so ago. My version of this answer is, I got to DC in 2015. I got to sit down with a guy named Dr. Fred Kagan, who is a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. He's a person, once again, who was very focused on the surge in Iraq in 2007. I asked him about grad school, and he just gave the basic advice that go to grad school if, as you're advancing in your career, you just hit a point where you just can't go any further without a graduate degree. Now, obviously, a person who's just like a serious academic, so you want a PhD, you want to get tenured at a university, you're in a kind of separate category. We're really talking about like professional master's programs, like the Georgetown Security Studies program or the John Hopkins program. GW has a program like this. There are a bunch of programs, like Harvard has a bunch of different masters in public policy. So his point was, when you hit a ceiling where you're doing great work, you're really growing, but for whatever reason, you can't get promoted, you can't get your next job, and it's all because you lack a degree, you know what? Then you should probably go get a degree. That was the perfect advice for me, because I've just found that my focus on podcasting and interviewing and moderation and just like having a real diverse set of intellectual interests that I think provide and could coalesce in a coherent whole has just actually meant that I've just never had a situation where I've needed to get a graduate degree. I showed up in DC, I got a job at PBS, like no graduate degree. I go to think tank world. No one asks about my lack of a graduate degree. They just focus on the fact that I had come up with an entrepreneurial pitch for the Realignment podcast. This is Hudson Institute. And then I just kind of got more jobs. I got a job in the tech industry at OnDeck. Obviously, the tech industry is especially a industry that is not particularly interested in graduate degrees. And then now that I work at UT, both at the Climate Center and the Strauss Center, just my focus on a category, once again, media, content, thought leadership, is just such that like a PhD isn't particularly relevant. But then at the Strauss Center, where I'm a senior fellow focused on technology, national security, and those broader issues, just the fact that I'm so deeply intersected into the tech world has meant that that in of itself is a credential that's just very useful. So lesson from my career, don't do this arbitrarily, especially if you're taking out loans for it. Really focus on hitting specific points. We're looking to make a big pivot. Because I'll also kind of note that what Sagar did in his case is he spent his first year of his career after graduating from GW in 2014 actually working at Macy's in New York City. And he, as you know, listeners will know, like I would not say Sagar is someone who's going to be particularly successful climbing the ranks of a failing, failing department store company trying to compete futilely with Amazon. So he used his graduate degree to just really make a big pivot. He got a job at ISW as an intern. He got a job at the Daily Caller, and he combined that with his graduate degree focus at the Georgetown Security Studies program to really get a real leg up there. So that was just a situation where the grad degree, especially given the fact that the Pentagon reporter job he did led him into working at the White House as White House correspondent, which got him noticed at The Hill, which gave him Rising, and then he met Crystal there, and then they go to Breaking Points. That all was really, really key to it. Okay, next question. We're going to do a slightly funner one. Dressing up. Hey, on one of your recent episodes, Marshall and Sagar, you two mentioned dressing up for professionalism in reference to the G7's unserious look from some of the leaders that were in attendance. For someone like me who isn't really used to formal attire except for special events, can Marshall in particular give me some quick tips to look more professional for disaffected males? Look good, feel good, right? This is funny for me because I, like I said at the start of this episode, I was in Dallas for an event. And because I was moderating an actual panel, I just put on an actual suit and put on a tie. And it was just so great because it was just simple. I wear my black shoes with my dark brown socks, with my navy blue suit, and then I put on my light blue shirt with a brown and navy tie. Trust me, this look worked. The kind of funny situation we're in right now is that we're in this weird kind of like business casual slash, if you're in tech, you'll just like wear a t-shirt. If you're doing business casual, you'll maybe wear like a blazer or a suit jacket that's been repurposed as a blazer and just wear a pair of jeans. And maybe you'll have like joggers or a casual sneaker. It's actually incredibly confusing and incredibly difficult. So at a core level, I think there was really this idea, and I think this is entirely understandable, that we over-formalized our culture, especially in the 1990s. Like, think it's, you know, if you watch The Office, it's kind of weird that, you know, Dwight and Michael and Stanley and Jim and all of them are like wearing ties and they're just selling paper. Like, that probably isn't necessary. But just in general, just thinking of formal wear as this like straightforward thing, you don't have to make any choices, where you just know your dress pants or your trousers and your suit jacket or your blazer and a white shirt or a baby blue shirt. It's just so simple. And I really love doing that at this conference event. So my just quick suggestion for folks, here is what you should do. You should get just a straightforward pair of brown and or black dress shoes. You should get a pair or two of khakis. You should get a suit and you should get a blazer and then two or three shirts that you could kind of mix around here. Given these categories I just described, like, you will be good to go for basically any environment. If you get the right colored blazer, like a navy one, you could wear that with jeans or something like that. So just getting like a straightforward wardrobe that you treat that way is like a really good way to go and isn't going to set you back that much, especially if you get everything properly purchased, like either by getting it tailored or getting it off the rack. Lots of good ways to actually do that. Next question, getting young people to vote. Young people and the kind of person who watches YouTubers usually don't vote. You understand you understand the cynicism and despair behind that, but is there any way to get them to invest in politics so their concerns register? Obviously, there are obstacles in their way, like primaries meant to keep them out. David Foster Wallace even argued back in 2000 that making young people cynical was an establishment move to discourage the youth vote. But it seems like there is a doom spiral happening where their disinterest keeps them from getting served, which keeps them from being interested and helps keep politics broken. Yeah, great question. And this is actually why I spend a lot of time pushing back against theories or, to be ungenerous, conspiracies around like, well, American politics is just unfathomably corrupt. Politicians don't listen to people. Ideas don't matter. Because, you know, in those categories, if you just take those ideas to their logical conclusion, and a lot of people say these things on YouTube, it basically just means there's just no purpose of actually participating in the political system. And that is just, I think, frankly, not great. If your critique of the political system is that it doesn't work for you, the solution to that isn't just sitting out from the process. It's actually like building a coalition and manifesting your action with other people. So I just think that there's this real danger that new media especially gets stuck in this doom loop of telling everyone that how broken the system is, which is only going to actually work to tell people that if the system is broken, then don't participate in the first place. So my real suggestion here is always going to be, hey, the system has always different problems in it. It, in many ways, actually, I think can be argued is broken. But in every single case, action, participation, engagement is actually the means of addressing your actual concern versus just sort of like nihilism that leads absolutely nowhere. I think if there's one thing that's actually pretty clear, if we could learn something from like the Trump presidency, the fact that like low turnout but actually turned out in 2016 Trump voters, they shifted the entire American political system on a bunch of different issues that we cover on the show every week. So that's just a real way of understanding how, like, when people whose voices aren't normally heard register, the system actually really does shift at a broader level. Politicians, and I speak this as someone who earlier was honest about me being a reformed politician when I'm sort of like approaching a lot of these topics, politicians respond to incentives, they respond to constituencies, and I promise you, it's true that there are definitely like corrupt people and people like Senator Menendez, who have like the gold bars that are coming to them via Egypt. But I'll tell you broadly, though, the vast majority of politicians are people who seek power. They want control. They want to have their names in the history books. And if they see that there's an actual body politic of people who are activated around the issues that you're activated around, I think they will largely follow that in many ways. And that really comes down to a turnout issue and not just seeing these things in an unhelpfully cynical way. Okay, next question. How to ask good questions. Dear Marshall and Sagar, hope y'all are well. I've been deeply educated and have gathered great benefits from listening to your work since the inception of the podcast. Thank you for both of your work across your mediums and the service you two provide. Marshall, following you on the realignment and counterbalance, I admire and never cease to be impressed by your question asking. I'm guilty of giving a fist bump every time the guest says something along the lines of, that's a great question, I never thought of it like that, or I'm really glad you asked that, etc. Thus, my question for you is, what is your process for conjuring up questions? I imagine a lot of it has to do with your skill of active listening, but can you share or provide any tricks or tips that have helped you become a better interviewer / host? Yeah, so number one, I say this to authors, just no one does the reading anymore. And by the reading, I mean the books, long form articles, serious podcasts. A lot of folks, especially in media, when they're doing an interview of a guest, like what and I used to do this when I was a producer, you will get your researcher or your production staff to just like write 10 to 20 questions for you, and you give a bit of input, but like they would have read the book, they give questions, you add in a few bits that really catch your interest. My just big secret here is, since I just read a lot, if not all of the book, and just spend my time swimming in the spaces that these authors and these guests are working in, that just means that I actually just have a base of knowledge and a real base of interest and an ability to tie these things together in unconventional ways that I think is going to get a positive reception from the guest. So part one is really just a simple, just do the reading, and that takes care of 90% of it. But then two, and the question alluded to this, is just the act of listening. If I'm also going to go back and critique 2010's College era Marshall, I was definitely a bit of a show off in classroom settings and like poli sci classes. And what I mean by that is I would just like ask questions, not because I was curious for the answer or because I had like a legitimate like real disagreement, but really just this, like, I want to be heard. I want to be at the front of the class. I want people to really notice me. So I think I've done a pretty good job on the realignment of just like throwing all of that out and just actually asking questions that I am genuinely interested in or that the audience wants to really hear. This is also why I think I'm pretty good at kind of saying, hey, like, I don't inherently believe this, but I'm sure there are parts of like the left or the right parts or the center parts of this audience who'd be curious for your thoughts on this. Like, what do you say to their pushback to what you're articulating here? So I just don't ask questions that I'm not interested in. And honestly, I think I take that too far sometimes because I look at the transcript and I sort of like ask this like super niche, a little too long, like not sequestered enough question. And that really stems to me saying like, well, I don't want to really ask like Annie Jacobson about like the first week of a nuclear missile strike. This is an episode I did recently because like I've read her books. So I don't know what she's talking about, but like the audience hasn't read the book. So I could do a better job of actually just like being like, no, like it's great for you, Marshall, to have your own questions, but you could be a better podcast host by actually like writing out like five broad questions that can be narrowed into your interests. So that's just like a note on that. Speaking of interviews with politicians. After the Mike Gallagher episode, this is probably back in January 2023, the last time I interviewed him. After the Mike Gallagher episode, do you plan to interview any more politicians soon? Perhaps reconnecting with the realignment senators or J.D. Vance. So my most recent politician interview was with Senator Marco Rubio of Florida back in June. And I've actually enjoyed interviewing him because as with Representative Gallagher, I've interviewed the two of them like multiple times over the years. So it's just like interesting seeing like individual politicians respond to changing media and different levels of performance and different like intellectual projects that they're engaged with. All that said, my bar for interviewing politicians up until now has just been pretty high because it's just usually not that enjoyable of a conversation. Usually there's just like a lot of talking points. Usually they're looking for a version of Fox News or CNN or MSNBC where they get 2 to 3 minutes to kind of drop their talking points that are pre-written. Politician interviews are much easier when they're done in person. But just given all that, it's just like not a really well-optimized format. All that said, something I'm thinking a lot about right now is I'm really fascinated by the idea that we're going to have just like an incredibly open race for 2028. And what I mean by that is whether or not Biden wins re-election, whether or not Trump comes back into office in 2028. And obviously, like there's a world where if Trump loses, he could run again, but most likely that wouldn't happen. You're going to really have a period where after just 12 years of political instability and dissatisfaction, you're going to have politicians on both sides of the aisle trying to work their way through this realignment period as they try to actually run for the presidency themselves. That's the J.D. Vances of the world. That's the Chris Murphys. Those are the Ro Khannas. There's a lot of people in this category. And I think that as I think of how I'm going to format the show after the 2024 election, thinking hard about like this is really the space where folks who are trying to shift through this 12-year Trump era and what comes next, I think there's going to be a lot of politicians who are actually going to meet like the editorial standards of the show. So I'm like really looking forward to doing that. I just think there's just like a little too much uncertainty right now, and politicians have too much incentive to just purely play it safe to make it that fruitful as a generic place to go. Next question. What was the most formative era of politics for you? I grew up in my adolescence with Obama being elected in 2008 when I was 13 and being reelected in 2012 when I was 17. The Obama era was a very formative moment in my political evolution and influenced my politics as a millennial. What was the most formative era in politics for you? Was the Clinton era of the 1990s, the Bush and 9/11 era of the 2000s, or something else entirely like the Trump era in 2016? So I would kind of break this up into different categories, because I think, you know, as someone born in 1992, every single moment that the questioner listed out like really matters. So I would say for me, the most formative era would probably be honestly like 2021 onwards. And I say it that way because, like, the first 4 years with Trump, and this is ever from Trump, were really just this, like, unsettled period where everyone was trying to figure out, like, what were the new rules of politics, what were the new issue sets, in what ways had Trump changed or not changed Washington. And I think after 2021, everything from COVID to the supply chain issues to the Mark Andreessen time to build categories to the new consensus on China to the pullout from Afghanistan to the war in Ukraine following Russia's invasion, I think we really got into a situation where it was pretty clear where the big issues were going to land, and a bunch of the ways that the political ideologies and actual coalitions had shifted. So I'd say that's just the most formative one. I think we've actually had enough happen in the past 8 years to actually really draw conclusions, when in many ways in the 1990s, a lot of our conclusions were incorrect. In the 2000s, same thing with the Obama era. Early Trump era, we admit we didn't know what we didn't know, but they're still trying to work through it. And I think now we just actually know a bunch of things. So I would just really say 2021 onwards is particularly formative for me. Next question, Think Tank. Hi, Marshall. After reading your recent writing, you mentioned how you view the realignment as a think tank. I'm curious what it's like working at a think tank. So yeah, I work a variety of think tanks. The Foundation for American Innovation sponsors the realignment via the Hewlett Foundation and Knight Foundation. I also work at the Hudson Institute, where Hudson puts out my Arsenal of Democracy podcast. And I also work at UT, where I'm a media and journalism national security fellow at the Climate Center, and I'm a senior fellow at the Strauss Center out of the law school focusing on tech and national security. So lots of think tanks in my life. I think working at a think tank, especially during this incredibly complicated, unsettled period, is really, really great, because at a core level, I'm not paid in any of these jobs for how many views I get. I am paid to ask good questions and put out content that is resonant and important to viewers who are interested in these topics. So, like, the way I'll kind of articulate this, I put out an episode with Annie Jacobson. She had the nuclear war book, and that episode got like 26, 27, 28,000 views in a few days. So, like, really well, that went really well for an episode. By contrast, I did like a deep dive on TikTok with my UT colleague, Adam Klein, and that episode only got like 500 to 700 views. If I was purely a content creator paying my way via analytics and clicks and ads, that ratio of 700 views for TikTok and then 28,000 for nuclear would A, be a disaster for the TikTok video. But the actual conclusion would be, hey, you need to basically turn the realignment to a space where you book Joe Rogan guests like Annie Jacobson and just like do it a little more like academic-y. So that could be kind of like my niche. It's kind of like this niche of like, hey, like, what's the Joe Rogan topic, and make it a little more highbrow. That would be the obvious strategy. And if you look at the realignments, like YouTube channel, like what's like most popular, my most popular episodes, Peter Zeihan's also in this category, are people who are Joe Rogan-y guests, but I could just go a little deeper because of my actual background and the spaces I work in. And I'm just not interested in doing that. You know, whatever ego I've had has like long been like sated by that. And what I like to do is just say to myself, like, look, maybe there were only 700 people who listened to that YouTube version. Obviously more people listen to the podcast, but if only 700 people watched that full YouTube video, I'm totally okay with that, because A, I learned a lot about the topic, and B, I think those are probably the right 700 people, not counting the, you know, tens of thousands of audio listeners on that one as well too. So I just think that working in a think tank is really like key to understanding there are different ways of creating content, and you understanding how your business model reflects the content you create is just like really, really important. Because if, once again, if I actually had to care about views, this just wouldn't be the same podcast. I wouldn't have the same career I had, and there'd be a lot of opportunities that wouldn't be available to me. So that's the real pitch for think tank work. Next question, guest stars Marshall and Sagar. You both have recently guest starred on other podcasts, Marshall on Crystal Khan, Friends, Sagar on Flagrant. Do you guys enjoy going on other podcasts? I imagine reading the comments and reactions have to be different than you're used to on your own shows, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I would say I don't enjoy. So A, like, I'm always down to go on people's podcasts. There are a couple of people I need to get back to from their pitches. But I at a personal level, like, I enjoy talking to people who have, like, mutual interests with me. But right now, I haven't as much enjoyed podcasts because, as you all know, I'm not a pundit. Sagar is much, much, much better at being a pundit who is directly responding and giving a take on a subject. Like, once again, like, I'm a professional interviewer. I have, like, a broad thesis, and I have, like, specific topic areas. I have specific, like, policy objectives. But I learn and engage with these topics by asking other people questions that come from my reading and study, rather than me just sort of, like, pontificating, like I'm doing on this episode, about every single topic I kind of go over. So I'm a difficult podcast guest just because, like, my skill set just isn't as much suited for, hey, I've done this work to, like, really write down and articulate my views and be able to say them in 30 to 60 seconds in a compelling fashion. That's really the thing which I really take from Sagar so much. Like, I'm so impressed at his ability to, A, just have a opinion or a take on any imaginable topic, like, literally every single day on Breaking Points, but then also just really sum them up in, like, a discernible and understandable way that really has built his brand at a serious level. Like, as I think of, like, my future and those categories that I'm really honing in, like, once again, like, this, like, post-neoliberal political economy and economics, and then also, like, the defense industrial base issues, I need to do more work to actually just get my specific thoughts down on paper or down on the, or on the computer screen, so I could actually have, like, an articulated understanding of what I'm actually trying to do there. Because I think Sagar just writing, like, multiple different monologues a week does a huge job of making that work for him. Next question. Great work, Marshall. Is less Sagar intentional? I get this one all the time. Marshall, your interviews have been top-notch recently. I started listening to The Realignment years ago, and it was presented as a platform where you dig deeper. You deliver on that every week. I wonder if Sagar's absence on the interview episodes is intentional. Do you find it easier to do one-on-one? Is it better for the realignment format to have an interviewer with more moderated positions? Not dissing Sagar. We love him too, but for different reasons. So I would just say, like, outright, like, obviously, especially, like, post-Ukraine, like, Sagar and I definitely, like, disagree. And I'd say, like, an expanding set of topics, like, realignments lead people to different places. But that 100%, like, hasn't been the driver of Sagar not being on the interview portion of the show. Like, the actual driver of Sagar being on the show, not as much, is just the fact that, like, he's literally created, you know, a incredibly successful large YouTube channel, but in many ways is actually, like, a television channel. He's got a real staff. He has to manage fellow creators like Ryan and Emily. They are doing all this independent content. He's still producing content himself. He's sure running the business side of things. Like, there's a lot there. And when he was back at the Hill and he had to write monologues and just show up and then go home, that was just really conducive to taking, like, time out of your day to do long, 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 long form interviews. And that just isn't in the cards right now when it comes to the realignment. I will note that further proof that this isn't just personal on my part is I've been telling Sagar for years that his, like, real interest in, like, the UFOs and niche history and exploration and, like, battlefields, he was just at Gettysburg. I think that would make, like, a really great, like, Sagar Does Culture podcast. I'd be really interested in what Sagar's version of RE Something Interesting would look like, aka, like, talking about the things that drive his interest but aren't as political. And he just hasn't done that because he just hasn't had the time. And I think that's, like, a real bummer. And I hope that, like, after 2024, he could work on stuff like that. I'll continue pushing him on that, both on this feed and privately. But yeah, it's just, like, a reality of the fact that it's been 5 years since we got together when we were just, like, roommates in DC before COVID and had time just to do a podcast a week. And, you know, creation changes, podcasting changes, and I'm just pumped that we've been able to keep doing the weekend episodes to really give subscribers, like, the back and forth to everyone. A lot of people really came to the show for in the first place. Next question. It's the kids who are wrong. Hi guys, fellow 30-year-old here, and I'm starting to feel the effects of getting older. I'm curious, what are some things you just don't get that the youth are into? So my quick take on this is I do not agree with, and I get what's happening here, and maybe this is just like a super online thing that isn't real. I'd be curious what people think about this, but just the narrative that Gen Z just doesn't watch movies anymore because their attention spans aren't long enough. and that just like TikTok and Reels and Snapchat and long form media have just pushed people towards just like short form. I can't sit down for Lord of the Rings. I can't sit down for an hour and a half. It's just really depressing. I think just entirely wrong. And I think short form content just frankly just isn't good for you. And I know that sounds kind of like crotchety or kind of like, well, in my day, things were different. But I just really believe that film and media just really matters in a way that short form just doesn't. And there's a reason why we'll talk about like films decades after they came out. Like there are always like different TikToks and different reels that we won't be mentioning like 6 months from now. Just like culture has just sped up so much, but nothing has any tangibility or staying power to it. And I'm just incredibly interested in just the idea that like we could rediscover our ability to engage things that have actually truly stood the test of time. Next question, US-China collision course. What steps would need to happen to avoid a US-China conflict? It seems inevitable. So three things I'd say. Number one, nothing is inevitable. I think believing that something is inevitable ends up backfilling individual choices that you have to make every day in these situations. And it's a sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy. So that's number one, rejecting the idea that a conflict is inevitable. Two, I would say communication is just key. This is something Annie Jacobson was talking about. Continuing to communicate maximally between the US leadership and the Chinese leadership is key so that misunderstandings don't occur. Seems if we're looking at the 20th century and even the 19th and 18th and other centuries, so many wars and conflicts between rival powers occur because of just like baseline miscalculations or misunderstandings of actual intentions and desires, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So consistent engagement is key. But number three, and this is just where I disagree with a decent portion of the audience, but this is why I spend a lot of my time focused on the defense industrial base or focusing on the Arsenal of Democracy podcasting space and my UT work, I think conflicts need to be deterred. I think the US needs to make clear to China that we have a military who is not worth messing with, who is not going to be easy to defeat in a conflict. It's really a case, in terms of my interpretation of the 20th century, that wars occur when rival powers are not properly deterred from taking action. Hitler believes that the Allies, France, England, et cetera, aren't up to the task. The Japanese believe the US is a paper tiger that could be knocked out with a surprise attack at Pearl Harbor. I think we should be doing everything we can today to make clear that we are neither paper tiger nor unserious, and that at a core level, our military, economic strength, et cetera, is in such a pristine condition, in such a pristine state, that it's not worth the gamble of messing with it. So that's why I spend so much time focused on the defense industrial base and the Arsenal of Democracy category. Because in a perfect world, not even a perfect world, in the ideal end state of what I'm really describing here, we invest seriously in our deterrent capability in the US military so that it's never used in the first place. It's when we underinvest, when we undersignal, when we basically miss. When we give our rivals or enemies the perception that we are weaker or less committed than we are, when we actually are committed, that's what leads to real disaster. So those are the three steps that I would focus on. Okay, nearing the end here. Are you working on a book? I am working on a book. Now, I've been thinking about a book for a long time and I haven't really had like a good idea. So this is me articulating this for the first time for pure accountability purposes. So I would really like to write a book about Texas. So here's what I mean by that. So like, obviously I got to Texas in 2022. So I'm not like pretending that I have any like deep understanding of this state and all these different factors, but like I work at UT. I was born here. So I just have like a deep like interest in the state and its future. And I would really like to write a book that's a corrective to a lot of the ideas that were written about Texas in the 2010s. So like as part of moving here, I read like a lot of like those 2012, 2013, 2014 era Texas books that were basically focused on the following idea. The big idea was, okay, Texas is the future of America because it's getting increasingly diverse. And because it's getting increasingly diverse, you're really going to see a Republican Party, which is just really framed around like white Reagan voting patterns, unable to succeed. And there's a real opportunity to really turn Texas blue and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. On a couple of levels, I mean, obviously the, you know, Democratic candidates at the presidential and gubernatorial level have been doing better. But I just think that the like telling the story of Texas purely as going from a red state to a blue state not only like wasn't correct, but I also don't think it's useful, because if you actually look at Texas right now, like I genuinely think Texas is at the center of like all of the big trends of the 21st century. And that's what I really like to write about. So, for example, I read this great economist piece from around 20 plus years ago that basically said the following. It said, okay, so if you want to understand the New Deal and progressive era, go to New York, because not only do you have both Roosevelts emerge from New York, but you have Wall Street, you have the labor unions, you have like the workday, like all of the issues that are encapsulated in first quarter of the 20th century America are really in New York. Then the Economist article transitioned to Michigan. If you want to understand the arsenal of democracy, the rise of the automobile industry, America as a manufacturing power, understanding that like New Deal, World War II, and then post-war 1950s, what's good for GE is good for America period, is really, really key and really, really interesting. So that's something that you could take. And then finally, California was the last part of the article I was referencing, which was California is a state where you not only saw the rise of Reaganism, but also like market neoliberalism with like the tax revolts and deregulations of the late 1970s. But you really saw that define the next 30 years of American politics. I think Texas, in a way that doesn't inherently help either side of the aisle, is going to play a similar role. Like here are a couple of trends. So for example, Ezra Klein's written about this. Mark Andreessen on the more center-right American Dynamism side has written about this. One of the big challenges for America moving forward this decade and for the rest of, like, frankly, this quarter of the 21st century is just this question of, like, can America build? Can we build enough housing? Can we build enough chip fabs to reshore our domestic manufacturing capacity? Can we rebuild the energy grid? Can we do these very tangible, in the real world, post-COVID reckoning issues? And, you know, that's not happening in California, it's not happening in New York, it's happening in Texas. So understanding, and in terms of the book I'm kind of pitching here, understanding the issue of like, can America build through the lens of Texas is really, really, really fascinating in ways that I think give the left some street cred and give the right some street cred. Other category, race and ideology. So once again, my critique of the 20-teens books about Texas, they were all about this idea that look at Obama. Obama won re-election against Mitt Romney because Mitt Romney was this like hard ass on immigration. He said they were going to do self-deportation and we're just going to see a Democratic Party win because America's browning, the country's becoming majority-minority. By the 2040s, 2050s, the Republican parties, we know it will be extinct because we just see where history is progressing. Obviously, that didn't come about on a couple different levels, but especially if you look not only at Trump's 2016 and 2020 results, where he did surprisingly well with working class voters of color, we also see in Texas, especially in like South Texas, you start seeing that Republicans are starting to do better because Hispanic voters especially. If you are a working class Hispanic voter in Texas, you are starting to actually vote, not just like a Hispanic person from a previous generation, once again, more Democratic, but you're actually starting to vote much more along your educational and class lines. So you're starting to say, like, hey, look, I'm not voting Republican or Democratic because I'm Hispanic. I'm voting Republican because, hey, guess what? Like the Republican Party, especially the Republican Party of Donald J. Trump, is aligned with very much this like working class, like non-college educated diploma divide issue that's at the center of our politics right now. So I'd love to have a chapter focused on like actually on the ground, what is happening with this like racial depolarization, but class and educational polarization in this country. I could think of like all these other different examples, but like I think just like being living here, like working in UT, being interested in this realignment issues, I just think that like unironically, Texas is at the center of everything. Just the key sum up here is that unlike the other 20 teens books, my book idea isn't basically propaganda for like one side or the other. So it's not like, hey, like look at Governor Rick Perry. He's really proven that California is the past. Texas is this like low tax, low regulation state that does all this cool stuff. Like it's the future. I've read that book, but I've also read the like, hey, look at Beto O'Rourke. Look at Wendy, you know, look at Wendy Davis. They're going to win because Texas is going to turn blue. Both those 2010s takes are just not correct. And I think there's a real opportunity to contribute something new. So I know I have a lot of Texas listeners. If you have thoughts on this topic or like different like modifications or like holes you could poke at my thesis, I'd love to hear from you. Obviously, I'd love to hear from like non-Texans as well. But I just am really obsessed with like a lot of the work that I'm doing here, building into that category and what's really going on there. So this has gone for a while. I'm recording this late at night and I am doing this straight to the mic. There will be very few edits here. So I just want to say a huge thank you to everyone who is just listening this far in this conversation, to everyone who subscribed to the Realignment Supercast and submitted these questions, and then for people who just listen to this show every time one comes out. I put a lot of content, as I said at the start, and I just really appreciate getting the chance to just work with you all and contribute thoughts and like build this like really fascinating space. So if you would like to renew your membership or just support the show, you go to realignment.supercast.com. And I look forward to sharing the latest RE Something Interesting episode with you all this upcoming Thursday.